Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday morning. It is the 10th of May and 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. We're very glad to have you with us on this Monday morning. Hopefully you had a beautiful weekend, certainly for Mother's Day. I hope you all had a gorgeous weekend for that celebration. Let me go to remind you first that you can be a part of our program. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you. Then we'll go and introduce everybody so we can get started on a busy news day. We go to Alan Jartok. Good morning. How are you?
Well, just ducky. It was rainy this morning, and so I couldn't walk in the dark, but I walked in the light. And it was good, but I dropped my glove.
Oh.
And it's gone now. You know.
You dropped it along the way and you did not know where you dropped it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, get up
better
there,
to walk, by the way, just better to walk in the light than toward the light.
Very well put. Very well put.
Yeah.
It's why you're the brilliant man you are.
And just, you know, if you walk in it, that's great. Libby Post is with us. She is a political consultant and our dear friend. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. How are you?
I'm well. A belated happy Mother's Day to you. How are you?
Oh, thank you. We went down to Wappingers Falls and had dinner with Alex and his partner last night. It was lovely.
Excellent. Wonderful to hear. Judy Patrick, and belated Happy Mother's Day to you as well, Vice President for Editorial Development of the at the New York Press Association. How are you?
I am fine. You know, we had a big Zoom Mother's Day meeting last night, and as much as people hate Zoom, I do think it is very valuable for drawing people from, you know, far away together in one spot for a happy Mother's Day celebration.
Yeah. Well, better, you know, better than nothing, right? I mean, better than not seeing everybody. So that's good. And Sarah Rogerson, happy Mother's Day to you as well.
Well, thank you. I had a wonderful day in the garden with my children.
Wonderful. How old are they now?
8 and almost 11.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Magical ages.
I know. Yes, they are magical ages.
Uh-huh.
Sarah is Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic. And we welcome you all to the program this morning. Delighted to have you here. Let us go to talk about what is happening in the world. A lot of sort of things that could be the top story. I'm going to go with the number one Republican in the House endorsing what could be the number three Republican in the House, Lee Stefanik, yesterday. McCarthy officially, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, officially backed Lee Stefanik to replace Liz Cheney in the House leadership. We need to be united, said the Republican leader, who worked behind the scenes for days on behalf of Representative Lee Stefanik of New York. The minority leader on Sunday officially endorsed Stefanik in her bid to oust the number three House Republican, Representative Liz Cheney, who has hemorrhaged support over her repudiation of former President Donald Trump's lies about election fraud. "Yes, I do," Mr. McCarthy told the Fox News host Maria Bartiromo when she asked whether he supported Ms. Stefanik's push to become the Republican conference chairwoman. "We need to be united, and that starts with leadership. That's why we will have a vote next week." The endorsement from McCarthy, who has been working behind the scenes on Ms. Stefanik's behalf for days, came after Mr. Trump and Representative Stephen Scalise of Louisiana, the number two House Republican, endorsed Ms. Stefanik. The move made clear that fealty to Trump and willingness to embrace his false claims of election fraud have become the ultimate litmus test among Republicans for holding a leadership position in the House. Ms. Cheney, who represents Wyoming and was once considered a future speaker, has a more conservative voting record than Ms. Stefanik, but Ms. Stefanik, a fourth-term congresswoman from upstate New York, has joined in Mr. Trump's efforts to cast doubt on the legitimacy of President Biden's victory in the 2020 election. All right, Alan, what do you think?
Well, I think the Republicans are being stupid, and here's why. the fact is that they are united in the Trump brand, right? We know that. So, but that is dumb because, Trump is doing very badly in terms of the way that the American people see him. So they are, in order to keep their jobs short term, they are bowing and scraping and kissing the feet of Trump. These are the Republicans. But on the other hand, when you read the polls, they're doing very badly. Now, should they have the kind of courage that Liz Cheney has? Of course they should, because it's the only way to get back the suburban vote, the middle class vote. But they're not doing that. In the meantime, Biden's numbers are very high. So they keep messing up in terms of the short run satisfaction that they will have of keeping their jobs while giving up the Republican claims on winning major elections. Now, will they win in Congress? Maybe, because they have, we all know, gerrymandered like crazy for some of those districts. Nevertheless, Joe, long story long, Charlie McCarthy, you may remember Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah. Said Edgar Bergen's, yes, one of so three.
Who do you think, whose dummy do you think this McCarthy is? We know he watched what happened on January 6th, pleaded for help, and then turned on his heels because he's so interested in staying where he is as the leader. That's all there is to it.
Judy Patrick, let's go to you as living in the district, as I do, of Lee Stefanik, of our representative perhaps becoming the third top Republican in the House.
Yeah, it was interesting to see that she, a political reported last week, that she is telling, you know, ultra-right Republicans that she intends to just serve one term in this position before seeking the top job on the House Education and Labor Committee. So she's like a short-term or short-timer. So as someone in the district, I'm also, you know, I'm concerned about her ability to represent the district. I'm concerned about the fact that there's a flood of money into her campaign coffers. Although, I mean, that's nothing dramatically new. She, $1.1 million flowed into her campaign in the first quarter of this year. Most of that came from Republican PAC. So, it's interesting to see the flood of money, especially McCarthy's. Kevin McCarthy's own PAC sent her a lot of money. So from the district, we're worried, you know, you tend to be worried about, you know, is she going to take her eyes off, you know, her constituents' needs. It's interesting she's no longer beating up on Andrew Cuomo. If you remember, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, that was the drumbeat for her. And now she's got her sights and her ambitions set on different things in the House.
Is her anti-Cuomo store still up? She had the...
hey,
you know,
Jim,
I don't know.
We have to look that up. Yeah. Go ahead, Alan. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, hey, Jude, borrowing a little bit here. Can she lose in that district? It was represented by a Democrat, Owens, for a long time. Now she's there. We've all heard how popular she is. There's going to be a redistricting coming up, and we don't know what that's going to look like. So the question that a lot of people are going to have is, could she get kicked out of Congress?
You know, I was talking on Facebook with some friends about this district because I think of it as a district for a long time represented by Jerry Solomon, who was a very strong Republican. Sure. And then, you know, John Sweeney was in parts of this district. The poor district has been, you know, reshuffled and reorganized so many times. But I do agree that there are an increasing number of Democrats and independents in the district, and I think she could lose. I mean, like a lot of Republican areas, there is a diehard Trump component here. But there is a strong anti-Stefanik sentiment. I think she was able to win in part because she had moderate views for the first couple of years she was in office. And then, you know, in the last, 12 months, 18 months, you know, she has dramatically changed. She was a moderate. She was a bipartisan lawmaker for quite a bit of time, and I think that won her support even among independents and Democrats here, and that will definitely change if she continues to pursue this path, which she must if she's conference chairman.
Libby Post.
Well, you know, the redistricting is going to probably pit her against Claudia Tenney, which should be an interesting primary if they actually do that, primary one another. And it's like, who's worse, really, between the two of them?
Yeah, but Teddy is much weaker, isn't she, Libby?
Oh, yeah, she is. Oh, she's much weaker, but, you know, it'll be the battle of the right-wing titans. And Stefanik would probably win. It's all according to how the district is redrawn and all that sort of stuff. But Judy's right. I mean, I've worked on campaigns when Jerry Solomon was the congressman, and it was, you know, Warren, Washington, Saratoga, Rensselaer, Columbia, and I think Dutchess.
Right.
And now, you know, it's like Rensselaer and up to the north all the way to Ogdensburg, you know, all the way across that swath. You know, look, Elise Stefanik is an opportunist, a political opportunist. It's just that simple. Wherever she can build a power base, that's where she'll be. That's why she has, you know, embraced Trump 100%, embraced the big lie 100%, because she knows that's what her constituents want to hear, the majority of them who vote for her. That's what they want to hear. All she needs to do is drive through the district and count the Trump flags that are still up. And she knows that she's safe in that perspective. If they redistrict and they move these counties around a little bit and give the Democrats a bit more of an edge, it is possible that a blue dog Democrat like Bill Owens could win in a revamped district. I don't think it's possible for anybody to do it now. That's for sure. You know, in this current configuration, but she's just a political opportunist, and you know, she'll go wherever she can get the most power. It's just that simple.
Sarah Rogerson.
I agree with everything that Libby just said. The only thing that I would add to, though, is that it's reflective of the polarization of the people in the district, right? If you spend any significant amount of time in the Adirondacks, camping or enjoying, you know, vacation properties or what have you, like during the Trump administration, I feel like the divide became even more entrenched and vocal between people who support and reject Trump, like more amplified than even elsewhere in the state for sure, and maybe even elsewhere in the country. The volume is just so loud. There's no one's hiding anything anymore. It's either you're in this group or you're not. And she's harnessing the moment. You know, this is what Trump intended to do. This is what he gave to Republicans, and now Republicans have to figure out what they're going to do with it. And unfortunately, it looks like they're getting in line and trying to, because what they're doing is coalescing the power that they have left. It's like the last gasp of the patriarchy is going to be violent and coordinated and strategic and intentional and deliberate, because they have to be. I really want to hear more from the Republican voices that are not on board, and they're not winning the battle of rhetoric or the normative battle right now.
Well, I'm really fascinated by that, Sarah, because, and this is for whoever wants to take this aspect of the question, but we heard a lot last week in op-eds and so forth from conservative Republicans who were very upset. And a lot of editorial writers who were pointing out that, yes, Elise Stefanik's record was much weaker when it came to conservative values than that of Liz Cheney. So the only thing that they are voting on is the fact that she believes in, quote unquote, the big lie. So that to me seems short-sighted, but I'm just wondering where are all those other conservative Republicans? Are they willing to go along with this? And what does that mean for the strength of the party moving forward? Alan.
Well, it's all about Trump. I mean, you know, we can say conservative and all the rest of it, but in the end, they're scared to death of Trump. They're scared to death that he will oppose them, that he'll put a primary person up against them. And they, for want of a better word, are chicken.
Libby?
Oh, you know, I think it all comes down to that. Those You know, you've got a handful of Republican congressmen who are calling this out as the big lie that, you know, the tent needs to be big. We need to respect divergent perspectives, blah, blah, blah. You know, you've got a base that will believe what it wants to believe because it affirms their bias against, you know, people of color, against women, against lesbians and gays, against anything progressive. You know, and so if Trump says it was stolen, they believe it was stolen. It doesn't matter what the facts are. That's what's so outlandish about all of this. And, you know, Stefanik's going to do what Stefanik's going to do because she's a political opportunist. And Trump is going to destroy, ultimately, it may take a while, destroy the Republican Party. I can see it's going to be hard. I can see some of these more, I wouldn't call them moderate, but, you know, the folks that aren't embracing the lie, trying to maybe form a third party or create a new wing of the Republican Party. But these guys, it's all about the primaries. It's all about keeping power. It's all about winning, you know, and they see embracing Trump as the winning ticket because he has he's emboldened and energized the base that hadn't really been voting before. And that's what's so scary. And we have the same thing going on, you know, on the left as well, where DSA candidates, and I'm not saying that that's scary, but DSA candidates are energizing a part of the electorate that hadn't voted before. That's why we saw so many changes here in New York. You know, but they want, you know, the Republicans, the Trumpers, they want to believe the lie because it makes them feel better in the morning.
But you said that they might, they were thinking about winning. Okay, we got no seconds, but, you know, to me, it's a losing strategy about winning nationally.
Oh, absolutely. But they don't care. I mean, they care, but it's about maintaining their own party, their own base. It's maintaining their own position.
Absolutely.
Three.
That's right. What it's about.
Two. One.
One.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. First news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. A couple letters on the subject of the leadership post and Elise Stefanik. Alan says, way to go, Kevin McCarthy. It doesn't matter if it is all wise. The party just needs to be consistent. How bad of a policy is that?
Wait. Alan said, way to go, Kevin McCarthy? No.
No. The name of the person. And they said, way to go, Kevin McCarthy.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, read the first sentence again. I'm sorry.
Okay. Hold on.
Alan said.
No, it was Alan is the letter writer, not you.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Robert says, good morning, panel. I live in her district. I've been broadcasting about her slippery, insidious choices to ride the Trump train to the White House. We must resist her efforts. She signed a seditious petition denying Biden's election. Now is doubling down on that, really. Then we go to Russ. The question, it seems to me, is what unified message Mr. McCarthy wants supported. Resistance to wealth and capital gains tax increases. More likely, the Republican plan will be to run on implied support for nativism and cultural grievance without ever explicitly saying so. This should very well play in about 20 states, but it's a short-term strategy. Well, I think that's what we're all saying, right? That it's a short-term strategy. Then we go to Keith.
Well, it's short term.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's short term in terms of the national picture of what happens in the Congress and the rest. But it isn't short term in terms of saving their own keisters. And that's the only thing that seems to matter to them. You know, they're losing in the court of public opinion. Biden keeps doing better. They keep doing worse, and yet they continue to do it.
Libby?
Well, they continue to do it because that's what they think their electorate wants. And, you know, and it might be true. Some of them will get reelected on this, but then there's going to be others who will lose in a primary to someone further to the right, and then the district that they're in will be like, yeah, I don't think so, and bring in a Democrat. There's that in the short term, but in the long term, you know, the pendulum always swings back to the center, and overall, the United States is a centrist country, and you know, this kind of reactionary rhetoric, because it's not radical, it's reactionary.
Yeah.
You know, is not going to play well in Peoria when push comes to shove.
Judy Patrick.
You know, initially I viewed this whole Liz Cheney controversy as like a battle for the soul of the Republican Party, but I know as it's gone on, I don't think that's right. I think the media has played that angle up way too much. If you look at Cheney's record, I mean, she's no principled Republican. She endorsed birtherism and, you know, some of the really bad things of the Republican Party in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. I think there is a principled Republican party out there somewhere, but it's not in this current debate at all.
Sarah?
Yeah, and it's, they don't have a Trump. Where, you know, the conservatives or the non-Trumper Republicans, they don't have they haven't coalesced around a unified voice yet. I think they're all trying to figure out who that should be. You know, all of the Elise Stefanik juniors of that part of the party are making their moves and, you know, trying to get invited to the right events and, you know, doing all the things you have to do in order to grow and maintain a power base. And so I think the midterm elections will be really interesting to see what voices come out. And of course, you know, the next presidential, we'll see. It's going to be a large, messy Republican primary full of wildly divergent views. And hopefully we don't have happen what happened last time, and the Republican Party bands around a non-Trumper. That's the only hope for them going forward.
Do you have a candidate, a coalescent candidate for the others other than the Trumpers? You said that they're looking around for one. Do you have anybody that comes to your mind that might be such a person? If it's not Liz Cheney, which apparently
it's not. I think that's the problem. Yeah, I think anybody who tries it now in this climate, they're still in a big Trump hangover. Nobody can emerge strategically right now without becoming a massive target, as Libby was saying. You know, they've got a really big, the big lie is a big hammer, too. And it's going to knock out dissentive voices. So they have to be careful.
Look, you get somebody like George W. Bush, not exactly a regular liberal. And boy, you know, nobody's listening to him these days. So I don't know who it could be.
What about this Adam Kinzinger, the Republican congressman who voted for impeachment? I mean, he's very articulate. I think he has a certain amount of stamina, and, you know, he's out there fighting, you know, it seems like the good fight at this point. The other person I think is going to be on that, you know, on those debate platform next when the Republican primary debates start, it's going to be Liz Cheney.
Yep. And Larry Hogan.
And Larry Hogan, yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Cheryl's note, who says Republicans don't really believe the big lie. They just say they believe the big lie. Republicans only care about staying in power, money, and white people. We've all watched them since Richard Nixon. Anything to win, whatever it is, we've seen them cheat, lie, and steal.
Yeah, but it's not, that's what I keep trying to say. It's not a winning formula. It's a personal winning formula for these congresspeople to stay in power and these senators. But it is not a winning formula in the United States to take political power. That's what's confusing me about all of this.
Stacy writes, let the Republicans have Stefanik, then let our New York Democrats remove her ability to get reelected. Free the 21st. should be the new rally call for the Democrats. The 21st district can be redrawn to oust Stefanik by including more Democrats. Bring in Amsterdam, Troy, Schenectady, and maybe Rome and Ithaca. Then let Anthony Brindisi or Paul Tonko beat her, and then have the remaining 26. I think this is like the dream world letter, but okay. And then have the remaining.
Going to Ithaca is a bit of a stretch.
And then, can you imagine Paul Tonko listening to to that letter and saying, "No, don't do that.
Don't screw this up." Anyway, they say problem solved. Two Republicans disappear, and possibly three if the numbers shift away. So that is
Well, the other side of that one is it looks, you know, we as I include myself as liberals. Think that might be a good idea, but it also may bring a backlash. In other words, there may be people who say, you see, they took her district away, they're getting at her, and that is the kind of thing that loses elections.
Right. Absolutely. Bob says, what is driving House Republicans following Trump is the pile of money Trump's election committee controls. As long as Citizens United remains in effect, elections will cost ridiculous amounts, and they will sell their souls to keep their seats.
6-3 Supreme Court. 6-3.
Yep.
That ain't going away.
Jason is reacting to Libby's comment. Just because in the past things have swung back to the center does not mean they will do so in the future. Remember, if you look at the history of the 20th century, many countries hit a tipping point into fascism. This could be that time here.
Well, I think that's a proper analogy, to tell you the truth. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You do or you don't?
I do. In other words, I think, and I said so this morning on an earlier commentary, that the crowds that are supporting Trump, the crowds that went into the January 6th nonsense, those crowds are very reminiscent of the crowds that surrounded the fascists. Look at the incredible Republican support for Trump. I mean, you don't have to be Einstein to figure this one out.
Libby.
No, I agree. It's a little scary, but I also have faith that the majority of people in this country, we have to remember that this is 30% of the electorate. We also have to remember that Joe Biden is incredibly popular right now. Even part of the Republican Party likes what he's doing. You know, those who still think, and critically. And so, you know, while these 30% will continue to wave their Trump flags and try to storm the Capitol and do all the rest of that stuff, the majority of the country are not going to be behind them, which is different from what happened in Germany. You know, there was a very easy scapegoat, Alan and my mine's families, and it was a little bit of a different time. And I don't think we'll see something like that happen here. I do think we have to remain vigilant. You know, we came close. If we had lost this election, if Biden wasn't president, who knows what could happen. But for now, you know, as Biden continues to do the right thing, to rebuild the economy, to give hope to people, which is what they want, to put money, to put a chicken in every pot. You know, the anger is dissipating, not for that 30%, but for the others who felt left behind. So we just have to wait and see. I'm not saying it's going to be wave a magic wand and everything's going to be better, but I don't see the path to fascism as easy as.
We got this letter from Keith, a serious question. What's the GOP platform? They did away with their platform for the 2020 election other than supporting Trump. They talk about transgender high school athletes, critical race theory, and lying about the big lie. How does their platform improve my life? I'm worried about COVID, the economy, climate change, and highways. How can they even call themselves a political party? It's more like a cult than a national political party. Anyone on that?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I saw somebody contrast. Mm-hmm. It was Mitch McConnell saying that the Republican Party platform was to oppose Biden's policies at every turn.
Right.
And that was contrasted with Jen Psaki saying, our platform is to help Americans. And we are 100% focused on that. And right. so that goes back to Alan's point. Like, what's the long-term winning strategy here? It doesn't. You know, Biden's putting money in people's pockets. And you know, we're the end is in sight in terms of coronavirus, mostly. And things are looking up for Americans. So nobody, you know, I also agree. Like, the opposition to critical race theory doesn't. You know, they're falling into the same trap that they accuse Democrats of, which is, you know, these sort of conversations that are had among a certain group of people, right? And that group, then Republicans have been able to exploit elites, right? They're yep. falling into the same elitism trap.
Let's see. One more. Oh, well, we have a couple letters, so I'll take a break and come back. We'll get to those, and then we'll move on to other topics. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson all on the program. We will be, we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Sarah Rogerson, Libby Post. We're having some technical problems with, but you're back.
I'm back.
All right. Excellent. Good, good, good. First of all, my apologies to Stacy. I read the letter about the redoing of the 21st District, and I don't remember saying this, but apparently in her letter, she said Utica and I said Ithaca. And she said she's a history professor and she teaches New York State history and she knows where Utica is where Ithaca and Utica are located. And I apologize to her. I did not. My intention was not to. It was just a slip of the tongue. I was not saying anything more than that, I promise you. So apologies to Stacy. We go to Erica, who says the Republicans don't need a national strategy. All the extremists in the party get to keep winning their districts. They still get a platform. They still make lots of money. And all they have to do is wait for Democrats to do the hard stuff, and they take credit for it. They just don't care, and they don't need to.
Can I note that the Republican Party did adopt a platform in 2020, but because of the pandemic, if you remember, the convention was basically virtual. They just essentially rubber-stamped the 2016 platform. So there is a platform there. If you look it up, it does talk about, you know, highfalutin principles. So they do have something. It's just a replay of 2016.
Highfalutin principles. Debbie says Hitler gained power because business and industry thought he was useful. If big donors abandon the Republican Party, that will be the end of it. I think the role of voters is perhaps overestimated.
Well, and the thing is that big business is abandoning the party because of the voter restriction bills. So, we'll
which
see.
Are just gaining a number, right?
Yeah.
Let's go to this letter from Darlene. What happens to charges against Trump in New York? Now that he's out of office, we don't hear about them anymore. Is New York not pursuing these charges? Thanks, says Darlene.
That is a great letter. And I've just written about this myself, and I know we have a DA in New York who is not running again. And all along during the Trump administration, we kept hearing about how afterwards there was going to be hell to pay because the DA was collecting damning information that was going to happen. I'm very, very concerned that we haven't seen any real follow through here that the public can get behind and have faith in. I think it's a very good letter.
Anybody else on that?
I mean, Rudy Giuliani's apartment was just raided recently.
Right.
By who? Right? Like,
yeah, by the FBI.
Not by the DA. Yeah.
By the FBI. Yeah. Yeah. But like, you know, these agencies have to work in coordination with one another. You can't have the state, you know, charging ahead and screwing up a federal investigation. So there's always a tension there in terms of the balance. And I think everybody wants to get this right. You know, Trump is a master at evading, eluding, and fitting in those tiny little cracks where the light of justice can't shine. And so they have a very tricky tapestry to knit together in order to nail them on any of the, of this stuff. And so I imagine it just, it takes a long time. It's going to take years.
Do you think it can be in coordination that everyone's sort of working together, even though they're on separate paths?
To the extent that they can share information, it has to be. I mean, it's these types of cases, to the extent that they're criminal cases too, are the state in the United States against Donald Trump, which means, you know, there's, and in New York State, you know, there's a lot more information that they have and can get because of his residency and business property ownership in the state. So I'm sure on the federal side, it's a multi-state approach. On the state side, they have to be careful not to, and also not to tip off information that may be out there that they just don't have a subpoena for yet, so that it doesn't disappear, right? Like, it's very, it takes, I've only been involved with a few cases involving state prosecution, thankfully. It just doesn't come up as much in my work. But the ones that I have been involved in, I've learned a lot about how the pace, it's sort of like hurry up and wait in some cases. And yeah, to the extent that they can collaborate, they are. I mean, look at what happened in everything that was happening in the Epstein cases before he turned up dead. Right. There were many states, many different federal and state agencies involved in the investigation of that. And they just ran out of time.
Well, for whatever it's worth, I don't agree. I have great respect for you, and you're the lawyer. I'm not. Nevertheless, you know, Preparar got it done. He needed to indict people. He indicted them. It happened. I'm very concerned because I think the dark music should be playing here. We see a DA who has decided, even though he could have won easily, in my opinion, he's got a lot of opponents, but he could have won easily if he had stayed with the program and got something done. They've been collecting data forever. It doesn't seem right that nothing is happening right now.
We go to Harris, who said, I was completely wrong in believing that the GOP would celebrate the loss of Trump. After all, he almost single-handedly lost the election, the House, and the Senate, while he breathed a sigh of relief. To counteract the Republicans, we have to promote the economic recovery and the lower income taxes for low and middle-class Americans. It is always the economy that wins elections. All right. Let's see. We have there was also an interesting article in the Washington Post. It was an exclusive in the Washington Post yesterday and in today's edition. It's a long read, I'll admit, but it talks about the fact that there was this really long, very long process of working on the big lie. That the story that was that the election was stolen from Trump, and it dates back for several years, and so this article is talking about key elements of the baseless claim that the 2020 election was stolen from President Trump took shape in an airplane hangar in Addison, Texas, 2 years before the election, promoted by a Republican businessman who has sold everything from Tex-Mex food in London to a wellness technology that beams light into the human bloodstream. At meetings beginning in late 2018, as Republicans were smarting from midterm losses in Texas and across the country, Russell Ramsland and his associates delivered alarming presentations on electronic voting to a procession of conservative lawmakers, activists, and donors. Briefings in the hangar had a clandestine air. Guests were allowed to leave their cell phones, were asked to leave their cell phones outside before assembling in a windowless room. A member of Ramsland's team, purporting to be a white hat hacker, identified himself only by a code name. Ramsland is a failed congressional candidate with a Harvard MBA, pitched a claim that seemed rooted in evidence, voting machine audit logs, lines of code, and timestamps that document the machine's activities contained indications of vote manipulation. So now this information is being used again with this enduring myth that the 2020 election was rigged and was not one claim by one person. It was many claims stacked one atop the other, repeated by a phalanx of Trump allies. This is the previously unreported origin story of a core set of those claims, ideas that were advanced not by renowned experts or by insiders who had knowledge of flawed voting, but Hello. By Ramsland and fellow conservative activists as they pushed a fledgling company. It's a lot. It's a very dense story, but man, is it scary. Libby, what'd you think? We lost Libby. Alan, what'd you think?
Well, you know, anything is possible, Joe. However, I still think, and people are going to get tired of hearing me say this, that it's really all about Trump. Because none of this, I mean, he was a birther, he was a this, he was that, none of this could have had the kind of legs that I think it has, although I'm not sure, if it wasn't for Trump taking the lead in all of it and coalescing this group of people who do remind me so much of what happened in Germany as they defended their position, even as a minority, and got themselves into power.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson all on the program this morning. One story I want to get to, another top story, and the story is that the White House has declared a state of emergency after a cyber attack forced the shutdown of a vital U.S. pipeline. Experts said that gasoline prices are likely to be affected, you think, if the pipeline is back to normal in the next few days. But the incident, the worst cyber attack to date on critical U.S. infrastructure, should serve as a wake-up call to companies about the vulnerabilities they face. I did try to get our friend Jim Henler on this subject, but RPI was also hacked over the weekend, and I couldn't get through to the emails. So much for that. But we tried. Yeah, that's scary stuff, isn't it, Alan?
Well, it certainly is scary, and it is certainly, you know, I wish I could believe everything I'm hearing. In other words, yeah, we're back to it's all Russia, and it probably is. I mean, I have no doubt that these are bad guys. These are Putin's people. Putin is reported to be one of the richest men in the world, and he didn't get that way just from his salary as the premier, you know, the president of Russia. So here we go again. You know, there is a criminal gang. We all know that if you're running a criminal gang in a dictatorship, you probably have some relationship to the government. I mean, that's just an assumption. But who knows? And, you know, Trump had his relationship with Putin. Biden clearly doesn't. So here we are.
Judy, go ahead.
So how many wake-up calls are we going to have before we actually wake up? I mean, how many times has this happened? We've had cyber attacks again and again, and it still keeps happening. Part of the problem is you have millions of users, and you know they're clicking on attachments they're not supposed to, and they're, you know, it's a lot of times these hackers are taking advantage of vulnerabilities that are in the system that we need to address. Again, when you have so many people using an individual system that's connected to the internet, it's like a little leak that, you know, the nefarious actors can get into and exploit. And so it's going to continue to happen until every one of us needs to take cybersecurity more seriously. I'm at fault too. I use the same password way too many times because it's, you know, too complicated to use, you know, ones with, you know, X's and ones and ampersands. It's, I mean, that sounds like a simple solution, but I mean, I think it's that complicated and that simple at the same time.
But no offense, I mean, assuming someone hacks you, they can't like shut down one of the nation's largest pipelines.
but if I work for the nation's largest pipeline, that's true. That's a problem.
It is, absolutely. This is a pipeline that carries refined gasoline and jet fuel from Texas up to the East Coast to New York. And what ultimately they were hit by is this ransomware. And the operator of the system is Colonial Pipeline. And they released a statement saying that it had shut down 5,500 miles, which it says carries 45% of the East Coast's fuel supplies, in an effort to contain the breach. So there were disruptions on Friday along the pipeline, but it was not clear at the time whether that was a direct result of the attack or the company's moves to proactively halt it. So by Saturday, the FBI, the Energy Department, and the White House were all delving into the details. Libby.
It's a scary thing, once again, you know, the breach. And it's unclear, I think, what the... This is way above my pay grade in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Other than it's scary that, you know, everything is based online. I mean, you know, the whole thing, this goes back to the voting machine issue. It goes back to everything else. Whenever we talk about anything to do with online security, you know, between reading the election fraud article and this, it's like all our worst nightmares and Tom Clancy thrillers coming to life.
Yeah.
And it's just, it makes you feel a little insecure.
So the question is, if the gas goes over $3, up to $4 maybe.
Well, it's over $3 now.
Yeah, right. Somebody's making money, right?
Yeah.
So so that's always something that should stick in the back of all of our minds. If Aaron were on, maybe he could have helped us understand why prices go up. The gas companies, the oil companies, make a lot of money here. The Russians are to blame, but it's a fascinating question as to where's all that money going?
Yeah, into somebody, well, into rich Republican donor pockets.
Sarah.
If I can offer a little bit of consolation, it's that we have a new online master's degree program in cybersecurity at the law school, and it is going gangbusters in terms of popularity and people wanting to get additional degrees and certificates in order to be part of sorting all of this out, right? So we have, as the industry grows, the number of people interested in making sure that the system is secure is also growing. I don't know if that's happening at pace, right? But cybersecurity is just exploding in terms of a place where people are seeking educational opportunities in order to make the cyber world feel more secure. It's also a reminder, I think, this sort of what we've been talking about in terms of our over-reliance on fossil fuels. Still, the Trump administration interrupted so much progress on climate and fossil fuel dependency. And the Biden administration, I'm seeing in some of their infrastructure plans, are returning to that idea of sustainable energy sources. And we don't think about it when prices are low and everything's calm. It's when a tanker gets, runs into a rock or somehow,
right.
There's an explosion on an oil rig or a cyber attack on a pipeline that we turn our attention once again to the climate challenge.
All right, let's go to another topic here. 15 minutes past 10 o'clock. We go to the Arizona voting review, and this continues to be a story. As you may remember, we talked about this, that the state of Arizona turned their ballots over to a firm, a company, to try to look at the ballots that were cast in the 2020 presidential election. And then they were going to, this is in Maricopa County, and the board of elections said, okay, we're going to give this company the ballots, and then you're going to tell us what, you know, what really went on here. So the president, the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, has trumpeted this, if you will, about how great this is, and now there's a lot of questions that are mounting as to the legality of this. And which really perplexes me is why these questions of legality were not asked before the ballots were turned over, as opposed to after they are weeks into this count. But a makeshift review of the vote in the state's largest county has certainly pleased followers of the former president, but it is being widely criticized as a partisan exercise. The company who is doing it, the Cyber Ninjas, have said that they are, you know, have questioned this and believe that President Trump won the election. So then there's all kinds of questions, and the Republican president of the state Senate hired a Florida firm, the Cyber Ninjas, to conduct the review. Its chief executive had promoted on Twitter a conspiracy theory that Trump's loss in Arizona was the result of rigged voting machines. Journalists, election experts, and representatives of the Secretary of State, whose office is responsible for elections in Arizona, have struggled with getting permission to observe the review, while the far-right One America news cable outlet has raised money to finance it and has been given broad access to the proceedings. Claims of partisanship ballooned after it was revealed that one of the men who was hired to recount ballots, former state representative Anthony Kern of Arizona, was a leader of the local Stop the Steal movement and had been photographed on the steps of the U.S. Capitol when, that's right, during the riot on January 6th. Alan.
Disgusting. The whole thing is disgusting. I mean, just think about this for a second. The security around this thing is dubious, that's for sure. But it adds up to what Trump has been saying all along. We were robbed, and we don't care if it matters that people, you know, aren't giving us the information we need. We're just going to say it and say it and say it and say it. And that is why it is referred to as the big lie. And this is just one part of that lie.
Libby.
It's a futile exercise that they think they're going to find something that's not there. But once again, as Alan says, it just reinforces the big lie. I mean, you know, cyber ninjas or ninja cybers or whatever they're calling themselves. I mean, give me a break. I'm wondering if any of these people can actually turn on a computer.
Hey, Libs, what makes you think that they're not going to rob it themselves, that they're not going to make this stuff up?
I know. That's the thing. You know, that let's just make this up. You know, if they're good enough, they could forge a document. I mean, you know, it's not easy. People are forging their COVID cards these days. So how hard would it be to forge, you know, documentation that comes out of a voting machine? You know, it's just it's a monumental waste of time and taxpayer money. That's for sure. And even in the article, I mean, you know, it's quoted one of the Republican state senators saying, this is getting embarrassing. We need this
well,
to stop.
Yeah.
First of all, it was supposed to be done already or done next week. And it's not going to be done until August. I mean, you know, the competency level here is low. You wonder if these people can even count.
Judy Patrick.
Well, the lack of transparency, their refusal to really let journalists or other officials see what they're doing and talk about what they're doing is outrageous. The other thing is, you know, this is so haphazard. At least they've backed off on this one proposal they had. They were going to actually go out to voters' homes and ask them if they indeed did cast a ballot, and that was really viewed as an intimidation. I don't think they're completely giving up on that, but That's a serious problem. One of the things that, if you harken back to the Washington Post investigative story about the electioneering fraud issue, one of the things I learned there that was related to this Arizona case is there was a code that says that a ballot was reversed. So it's a code on a printout that says ballot reversed. And people who believe the big lie think that means instead of Trump, the vote got cast for Biden. That's not what it means, and in fact, it means that the machine didn't accept the scan. It just spit it out, so it was reversed. And so the problems that underlie the this lie are simply explained as that. It's this is ridiculous. They have to move out because of high school graduations coming up, and so they have to move pack everything up and move it to another location. That just shows how ridiculous this whole thing is.
Sarah.
Yeah, I was concerned when I read that part too, Judy, because that's just so much of an opportunity without the benefit of cameras or eyes on things for things to be made up for, you know, outside influences to change the results their own way. So I wonder at what point the federal authorities will intervene at some point, and maybe they're just waiting to see if it will self-implode, because once they add sort of the investigating something gives it legitimacy, right? So at what point do they pull the trigger and say, okay, we've got to step in? And I'm thinking particularly the former attorney in the Justice Department Voting Rights Division, right? At a certain point, this is impacting, and this is exactly what it's supposed to do. Delegitimizing American confidence in democracy and the sanctity of the vote. So it really almost doesn't matter whether they find something or don't find something. It's the story they'll tell afterwards and whether or not that flies with people and whether or not a higher authority has to come in and debunk yet another myth that contributes to the big lie.
And it just seems, and then you wonder, I guess there are other places that are either thinking about or in the process of doing similar things. And I don't know. It just, the fact that we're still, there are factions that are still fighting over the election is kind of mind-boggling, but I know that's
like enough already.
Right. You think we'd be done with it by now, but I guess not. All right. Let's see. We have a few minutes here before we go over to bottom of the hour. Let's see. Chris says, I can confirm that RPI's network has been down since Friday. Don't try to email us. It points to the importance of radio in this world. Please be sure that WAMC cannot be hacked. Okay, we will try. Let's see, then we got this that says Rachel Maddow has good reporting on this issue. The Dems have been trying to stop this. A local journalist spent the first day there as a volunteer and then was restricted after that. This is in regards to the to the recount. I'm with Alan, says Paula, on the alarming parallels that can be drawn between the Nazis' rise and their policies and what was stirred up by the former administration. For one thing, I've just finished reading The Ravine by Wendy Lauer. Some of the new Holocaust research, like the focuses on the strategy to destroy family units, which was, of course, what we saw at our own border, tragically masterminded by Stephen Miller, who himself had plenty of Holocaust victims in his own family.
He doesn't care. He does not care about that.
What's he doing nowadays?
What's who doing nowadays?
What's Stephen Miller doing nowadays? Oh, he's down to Mar-a-Lago.
Is he on Fox?
I think he's on Fox.
Do you have a gig? That's very nice of you to be worried about his employment, by the way. Greg says, I heard a good theory. It's not that Republicans believe Trump is their only hope in 2022 and beyond. It's that Trump has told key leaders that he has the power to blow up the whole party if they don't adhere to him as supreme leader of the Republican Party. Then we get this from Ken, please, everyone, use a password manager. They are easy to set up and use. Spend a few hours with the software to generate ransom passwords for all of your online accounts. See, taking your words to heart, Judy Patrick. Yeah. But then you have to remember them. Anyway. Let's see. Dear panel, why always blame it on Putin? You have no facts, only suppositions, yet you always assume it's the Russians. It could be anyone who has skills that can exploit a software program. It's very probable someone else is doing this to have U.S. tensions grow against Russia. Have you ever thought of that? Who gains by having Russia and U.S. tensions rise? That is the question you should be asking. This is much more complicated than you think. It could be very well a U.S. oil company or investment firm hiring a foreign hacker to create a double problem to raise oil prices and its share price. Well, when the White House comes out and says we're investigating this and we believe it's the Russians, I don't know. It doesn't make us right. That's
right. That's right. But those questions that were asked by the letter writer are perfectly appropriate, I think. We don't know. I mean, certainly we know that the oil companies are going to start making a lot more money.
Leo writes, the Republican politicians are focused on the big lie because it is a distraction. On January 6th, a danger to our democracy became evident. It will take real effort to bring the focus onto the threat to our democracy. Widespread falsehoods are a technique of any determined autocrat-oriented person or group to gain power over everyone. The intentional insurrection that showed in the development and guided attack of our nation's capital on January 6th is the evidence on which to focus. The big lie is just a distraction to keep voters from thinking about the real danger. The Democratic politicians are missing the opportunity to bring focus on the important issue, not just for their purposes, but the overall safety of all of us in our present way of life. Well, it can be both, right, Alan? I mean, to be concerned about both,
You could. When the White House tells me that it's the Russians, I tend to believe it. You know, when I did my thing with David Gustina this morning, we didn't have all of this information. But if the White House says that's probably this gang, I tend to believe what they say. Now, I'll admit that if it was the Trump White House that said it, I would have my reservations.
All right. We got here's a good letter to end this hour on segment on. Paul writes, is Trump done if the Republicans fail to flip the House in 2022?
No, of course not. Why would you say that? Trump is not done as long as he has I don't know how to put this without losing our license. As long as he has the approbation, or the folks who are scared to death of him. He doesn't lose. Why will they change? If they don't win the House, you think they'll all say, okay, enough of you, Trump, goodbye? No, not these cowards.
Libby?
Yeah, I'll take that.
Go ahead.
I'll say, Alan, that he will be done. If they perform poorly in the midterms, I'll say he's gone. So,
and I say, I hope you're right. I'm going to mark it down, and I'll say, I hope you're right. But I don't think you are. I think, look, he has got them in his vice, and it's that simple.
And
not going to change based on any external events.
We have to.
He won't be done until he's dead.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. We're getting a lot of mail about passwords. Ton of mail about passwords. I had made a statement. I stated that I was concerned that, you know, that one of the hard things with your passwords is remembering them, and then they said, well, that's the whole point of having a password manager, because then you just have to remember the one password, and then this generator will make up the passwords that changes at that point. My question then was to the letter writer, okay, but is it that, okay, that's good, but is it not possible then for the generator itself to be hacked? right? So you could yourself be hacked, but what if the generator is hacked? And is that the way I figured to word this was, is it impossible to have that hacked, or is it just statistically unrealistic? And I guess the answer to that was that not even the software company can get access to them because they're running on your personal computer and they're stored locally. So, but then if somebody does take over control of your computer, then yes, anything is possible. So, does that clear it up?
You know, I write all mine down on a 5x7 index card, but I lost the index card a couple of weeks ago. Thankfully, I found it just yesterday, but that's the safest way. But it's a lot of work. But you know what? To be safe, I'll do the work.
There you go. All right. Matthew makes a similar point. When you use a password manager such as Dashlane, you do not memorize the passwords. That's what the manager does. All you do is come up with one strong master password. The programs are free, or for a small fee, you can have it accessible on any platform. They are safe and easy to use. But then again, going back to the earlier questions. Okay, let us go to some other issues here and talk about other stuff in the news. Sarah, you're up on this one in regards to the president deciding to withdraw the Trump rule of collecting DNA from immigrants and citizen sponsors. The Biden administration plans to withdraw a Trump-era proposal that would have greatly expanded the biometric data collected from immigrants, quashing a policy that would have allowed the government to demand eye scans, DNA, and other data from those seeking to come to the U.S. The proposal from late in Trump's term never took effect, but immigration advocates were unnerved when the Biden administration earlier this year reopened the rule for comment, fueling concern the new administration would seek a similar pathway. So we're worried about our passwords, but what about our eye scans?
So biometrics have been gathered for as long as I've been practicing immigration law, which is just over, I don't know, close to 15 years now. And what I'd say, typically it's just fingerprints, okay? And it's not, I say it's just fingerprints, but those fingerprints get run through multiple databases. We still don't know the extent to which folks are screened. And I think the Trump administration was revving up on this whole fear, usually looking at the southern border and saying, blaming immigrants for all manner of crime in the United States, right? This isn't unique to the Trump administration. This has been happening since the founding of this country. It ramped up significantly after 9/11. And it's all part of a narrative that immigrants cause harm to Americans, which is the opposite of what is true. The Cato Institute, again, more recently, it issued sort of like a myth debunking, myths about immigration and why they're all false. Again, a more neutral / conservative think tank organization. So these aren't myths that are really glommed onto. The real damage is the idea that we could go from fingerprints to, as you said, DNA and eye scans. And with that information, once gathered, would follow people for the rest of their lives, even post-citizenship, right? So even saying that we wanted that level of monitoring, it would be interesting to see which applications were prioritized for this monitoring too, because I guarantee you it's not European countries who are seeking visitors or technological visas or employment visas in the United States, right? It would be a family-based petitions, which were a main target of the Trump administration. But you know, it's terrifying to think, you know, how long would this, it would be, I think the article said 6 million people every year apply for some sort of immigration status in this country. So we would be gathering that level of biographical information and storing it on 6 million people a year. And what would be done with that information? Huge privacy concerns, massive questions. I'm sure one of the questions that folks will be asking is, well, if we did all of this collection at the border, and first of all, they don't have the equipment to do that, but assuming that they did, wouldn't it have been easier to reunite families? The downside to get this level of privacy invasion completely outweighs any kind of benefit that would realize, and there are a million other less harmful ways to keep track of people for the purposes of reuniting them. So there's a lot to unpack here, and I'm thrilled that the Biden administration is ending this, because it did cause quite a lot of concern in the immigrant justice community when the rule was revived, because typically that means that it's going to start going through the process of being finalized. And it used to happen every Friday. For the last 4 years, there would be a different rule, and we'd engage our students and others in writing comments to the rule about why it was terrible. So it's nice not to have to do that again for this one.
All right. So what was the previous? So prior to that, I mean, what do we currently have? As I mentioned in the beginning of the article, this is something that that the Trump administration proposed late in the game and doing this. So what do we rely on now? I guess what I'm ultimately asking, is there a better way to go about than what we're even currently doing?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the fingerprinting is fine in terms of if you want to run criminal background checks, but we do that for our own clients, right? It doesn't do a good job of finding the people who wish to do harm to the United States. Biometrics were in place before for several decades, and it doesn't work as well. You know, immigrants are already subjected to tons and tons and tons of invasive background check procedures. Just a simple family-based application has to involve mounds of proof of things like a good faith marriage. And how do you prove a good faith marriage? Well, you know, the marriage certificate, who was at the wedding, do you have a scrapbook, what are the photographs that are available? And these are all things that are requested and in some cases required. We've been doing DNA gathering for family-based petitions for a long time to make sure, for example, that if somebody is applying for their child abroad to join them in the United States, that they're actually biologically related, which of course excludes a lot of family combinations that have nothing to do with bloodlines. There are increasingly communities all over the world who are families, and certainly in the United States, who have no biological connection to their children whatsoever because of technological advances or the, you know, death of parents and other people intervening and becoming the parents for that child. So there are already things in place that are harmful. This would have ramped them up 10,000-fold,
right,
to sort of skew against non-traditional notions of family relationship and who we are as Americans, who you have to be as an American.
Anybody else on that?
Well, as you know, one of the premises was that it was to detect people that could do potential harm to the U.S. But why was the proposal to gather this information about minors? It seems counterintuitive. It doesn't seem like a reasonable at all. I was surprised they are collecting DNA. I didn't realize that we were being that invasive. And you have to remember that data is power. And once you get data, you don't let it go. And there certainly needs to be, we need to be mindful of this as we go forward and allow people to to acquire more of our own data.
Anyone else? All right. We will finish off. So,
Joe,
yeah, go ahead.
Very quickly, Joe. Let me just say that I understand what this, who we are on this panel and our concerns for civil liberties. Nevertheless, if the price of getting folks in, as Sarah has tried to do to this country, depends on some of the technology, I wonder if you polled the American public what they would say, whether it would be worth it or not, in order to do what's right with the people who are coming into the country. Sarah?
Immigration and treating immigrants compassionately is a widely popular bipartisan belief in this country. The place where that gets interrupted is in places of fear, where people have fears about national security, fears about, in the conservative circles, family integrity. And that's why these types of rules introduced to monger that fear, to try to gin it up and to interrupt the more popular beliefs about immigration, which is that we should just leave these families alone and let them earn a living and contribute and to our tax base and be happy the way that all of our ancestors, many of our ancestors came willfully, right? Some were forced here. But in any event, that they're given a chance, right? That's the whole American dream. So it's intentional. It's always intentional. Donald Trump did a masterful job of blaming all of our problems on immigrants. And it's just not true. It's the other big lie that we have to, underneath the election.
Oh, yeah, we've got to go.
Yeah, we're out of time. But thank you to everyone. Thank you for a great morning and a lot of good conversation. We'll be back with the Congressional Corner after this.